Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. If you could please come in and take your seat. I'm sure we're going to still have people coming in, but we'd like to get started. So if you could all please take your seat. It's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker for this session. Noah Feldman is, I think it's safe to say, one of the true superstars of his generation of scholars. He is now the Bemis Professor at Harvard Law School. He recently left NYU to go to Harvard. He has written a remarkable number of books for such a young man. Each one is better than the previous one. He is not just a scholar of law, and particularly constitutional law, constitutional history, American history. He's also a scholar of Islamic culture and Islamic law, as reflected in a number of his books. He not only teaches about constitutions, he actually writes constitutions. He was principal advisor in the drafting of the Iraqi constitution. He was himself a law clerk to Justice Souter, and his latest book, which unfortunately we don't yet have available for you, but I'm sure after hearing him talk about it this afternoon, you want to go right to Amazon and reserve it if it's possible yet, or certainly get it, is about the Supreme Court justices in the era of Franklin Roosevelt. Noah is returning to Aspen this year after an absence of, a few years, Noah, because of small children, and people still talk about his presentations here at an Ideas Festival 4, even maybe at our inaugural one, I have forgotten. But without further ado, it is my great pleasure to bring up my friend Noah Feldman.
Thank you very, very much, Elliot. And I really would like to say thanks to Elliot and to the Aspen Institute for having me out here and to all of you for coming out. What I'd like to speak to you for a little while about today, with your permission, is four figures, all allies and friends of FDR, who are really founding fathers of the Constitution that we have today. That is to say, as you know, the Constitution as written 220-odd years ago is not actually the Constitution that we have in practice. It was designed for a small republic in the late 18th century. We don't have those things anymore. It had to change and evolve, and it did change and evolve, most importantly for our period, in the period of the New Deal, the Second World War, and the Cold War. And it emerged in that period. The change that occurred took place in reaction to those global events, to the global events of depression, war, and the threat of communism. And there were four justices, all named by Franklin Roosevelt, who became the central figures in designing the Constitution that we still have today, and they did it via the Supreme Court. The reason I'd like to focus on those people is in part because they're so fundamentally different from the kinds of justices that we mostly have today and the kind of Supreme Court that we mostly have today, and in interesting and, I think, instructive ways. Although the challenges that face the court and the Constitution today are in some ways analogous to the kinds of challenges and problems that faced the court in that period. What's most remarkable about the four men I'm going to describe to you is that they began their lives as liberals, as critics of Wall Street, and as close friends of Roosevelt. But once they went on the Supreme Court and Roosevelt died, they split and they became bitter enemies. They developed profound hatreds of each other. Two ceased to be liberals altogether and became very important conservatives. And among the four of them, they generated the four main schools of constitutional thought as we know them today: judicial restraint, which we've heard a fair amount about, originalism, the idea that the Constitution is a pragmatic document that should be interpreted to solve problems, and last but not least, the idea that the Constitution is a living document that's designed to achieve liberty. So those are still today the four main schools of constitutional thought, and these four men generated them. Let me say a little bit about the background into which they came. As you know, in the 19-teens and 20s and into the 1930s, the Supreme Court was made up of a 5-4 conservative majority. They were called the Four Horsemen, and then they had one other conservative who went with them, which blocked systematically all laws passed by states or the federal government that improved health and safety or limited workers' hours or tried in any fundamental way to regulate the economy. These were progressive laws passed by majorities in the states and then after FDR was elected by the Congress, and the Supreme Court blocked them. And in that period of it blocking them, one man who was a professor with some real-world government experience, Felix Frankfurter, began to articulate the strongest criticism of the Supreme Court in that period from his perch at Harvard Law School. Frankfurter argued that the Supreme Court in this period was an activist court and that the correct thing for a judge to do was to be restrained, to hold back, and not to inject his or her, and in those days it was always his, philosophy of the economy into the Constitution. Now, no one had ever said before that the job of judges was to stand aside. And Frankfurter, being clever, did not claim that it was his idea. He attributed the idea to several of the Supreme Court justices at the time with whom he was personally friendly, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., probably the most famous Supreme Court justice ever, with reason, and Louis D. Brandeis, who was also a very close friend and associate of Frankfurter's, also a very famous justice. In fact, neither of those men was really deeply committed to judicial restraint for the reasons that Frankfurter put forward. But Frankfurter wanted them on board to give this critique of the court power, and they were, those justices were, dissenting from what the Supreme Court was doing at the time. So the first and most interesting thing to notice is that when judicial restraint was invented by Felix Frankfurter, it was a liberal progressive theory. It was the argument that the judges of the court who were conservatives should not be engaging in the creation of new constitutional rights, which were the constitutional rights of corporations, and which were rights of, quote-unquote, liberty to contract, the right to make a contract without the government interfering in the nature of your contract. And Frankfurter wanted the world to know that that was an illegitimate way of judging. Now, just to show you how the world was different then, Frankfurter was a very active public figure, often on behalf of Louis Brandeis. Before Brandeis had gone on the Supreme Court, he was called the people's lawyer, and he was a very well-known progressive lawyer, the best known in the country. We went on the Supreme Court. He had all kinds of causes, interesting causes, women's rights, labor rights, Zionism, that he felt he couldn't publicly be involved in now that he was going to be a Supreme Court justice. So he secretly paid Frankfurter a salary for the next 20-odd years to take those cases and do that for him, including cases that Frankfurter argued in front of the Supreme Court on which Brandeis was sitting. Now, they kept this secret at the time, but they also justified it to themselves on the grounds that Brandeis had made a lot of money as a corporate lawyer. Frankfurter had been an academic, had never made a nickel. Frankfurter's wife had very, very serious depression, was always in psychoanalysis, which was expensive then as now. In a world of Prozac, perhaps it wouldn't have cost him as much, but it was a draining financial thing for him, and we've got the letters of him writing to Brandeis, could you up the annual subvention so my wife can go into analysis with this analyst in New York? But they thought it was fine. They thought it was justified. And that's an interesting theme that comes out in studying the Supreme Court in this earlier period. The contacts between justices and the bench, on the bench, and lawyers in the bar, professors in the academy, and as I'll say in a few minutes, presidents were profound and deep. People were constantly talking to each other, and I don't just mean that in walking outside the auditorium, justices and lawyers would say hello and chat with each other and have dinner, right? Which is great, and I think one of the great things that the Aspen Institute does is to bring members of the judiciary together with people who are interested in the affairs that they work on. But I'm talking about close personal relationships, poker games like FDR's poker game, at which regularly two or three Supreme Court justices were in attendance. Same was true of Truman's poker games. And I'll just give you one example to show there wasn't only FDR, although I'll come to him in a moment. When Truman wanted to seize the steel mills in 1952, he wasn't sure whether the Supreme Court would uphold it, so he called his poker buddy, Fred Vinson, the Chief Justice of the United States, and asked him, what's the Supreme Court going to do if I do this? Right? That was considered completely normal at the time. Vinson said, oh, don't worry about it. They'll never strike it down. He was wrong. Okay. Tack back to the world of judicial restraint. When Franklin Roosevelt was elected by a landslide in 1932, he embarked on a process of adopting radical new legislation that fundamentally changed the face of American business. And in what was called the First New Deal, he adopted something called the National Industrial Recovery Act. And that act was very similar to corporatist models that were actually being used in Mussolini's Italy. It involved all prices being set by organizations of industry executives, labor leaders, and in theory, consumers, so they didn't have much of a say. They would get together, they would set wages in the industry, they would set quantities, and then the government would just sign on the dotted line, and whatever these organizations came up with was the law. The Supreme Court struck this down, with even the more liberal justices saying it was a grand overstatement of governmental authority. Roosevelt was furious, and in his whole first term, he never got a chance to name a justice, because the justices just kept on staying alive, as they still do. And so he threatened, famously, to pack the Supreme Court. He announced publicly that what he was going to do was get Congress, which he controlled, to pass a law that would say that if you were over 70, then you could stay on the court, but a new justice would be would be added to the Supreme Court to counteract you. That would have given him 5 more appointments. He would have controlled the Supreme Court. Then, miraculously, after he announced this, and there was a lot of opposition from within the Senate and a lot of opposition, indeed, from within the Supreme Court flipped. One of the justices, a man called Owen Roberts, who had not completely consistently but generally been a conservative vote, flipped to the other side and became a liberal vote upholding these decisions. It was inevitably called the switch in time that saved 9. And the court packing plan died. And if you're interested in that plan, I'd recommend to you a terrific book by a good friend of mine, a guy called Jeff Schessel, a former Clinton speechwriter, a really wonderful guy who's just produced a terrific book, really dense, beautifully written book, about precisely the year when Roosevelt was trying to push this court packing plan. There's a lot of debate about whether Roberts changed his mind because of the pressure or whether he didn't change his mind because of the pressure. I'd be happy to talk about that if people are interested. But what's important is at the time, everyone thought that that's what had happened. Everyone thought that that is why he had changed. Finally, in 1937, the guys who had stood against Roosevelt on the Supreme Court began to retire because the game was over. And Roosevelt got to start picking justices. The first justice he picked was Senator Hugo Black of Alabama, a man whose name you will have heard. Black was asked on the Wednesday when he was nominated by some of his colleagues in the Senate whether he'd ever been a member of the Ku Klux Klan, something which was widely rumored, and in Alabama, more than rumored. Black said, well, if any senator thinks I was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, they can vote against me. That was his answer, which I think we today would call a stonewall. He was nominated on a Wednesday. He was confirmed on Monday. That's how they did it in those days. No one in the Roosevelt administration asked him about the Klan. There was no vetting process. All it would have taken was to go to Alabama. About 2 weeks later, a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, which was a Republican-owned newspaper, a newspaper owned by a man called Paul Block, who was a Jewish Republican who hated Roosevelt and wasn't so crazy about the Klan either, sent his reporter down. The reporter paid the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, the former Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, an undisclosed sum, and he produced out of his drawer Black's membership card, his hood, and his letter of resignation, which said on the top, to be used if needed, and was signed ITSUB, in the sacred unfailing bond, Hugo Black. All hell broke loose, right? A sitting member of the Supreme Court was possibly still a Ku Klux Klan member, and certainly had been a Ku Klux Klan member. He hadn't had to lie in his confirmation hearings. Why? There were no confirmation hearings. No one held confirmation hearings then. The only person who had a confirmation hearing ever was Brandeis, because he was Jewish, so they needed to have confirmation hearings. Black went on national radio, and this is what he said. I'm only really slightly paraphrasing. He said, some of my best friends are Jews and Catholics, and some of my friends are Black. He did not apologize for having belonged to the Klan. Now, the background to this is actually quite interesting. He had joined the Klan because he wanted to go into the U.S. Senate. And he was a very successful local lawyer in Birmingham, which was a big successful steel town. But he had no statewide name recognition and no statewide organization. By joining the Klan, he got himself those things. Because in the 1920s, when he wanted to run for senator in Alabama, the Klan was a shadow political organization. It had local get-togethers called claverns. It had parades, literally. It was a way to go around the state and meet people. It was a built-in political organization, and he wrote it directly into the U.S. Senate. Then, in the years after he was elected to the Senate, the Klan's power in Alabama had really declined. And so Black thought he'd never have to worry about this again. For the rest of his life, Black, who was a Southerner with a deep sense of honor, experienced it as a stain on his reputation that he had, in this way, been humiliated by the making public of his Klan membership. And he turned into a racial liberal, a remarkable racial liberal. And years later, when the Supreme Court came to decide the Brown against the Board of Education case, the famous desegregation case, when it was first argued to the court, and the justices got together in conference to discuss it, there were four of them with experience of segregation, either from Kentucky, which was largely segregated, or Texas in one case, and Black from Alabama. And Black was the only one of those four justices who was prepared to vote to strike down segregation. And he was the strongest voice for it. And the basis for that was the constitutional theory that he developed, which was a theory of originalism. Here's what Black came up with while he was in the Senate. He said, the Constitution should be like the Bible, which I used to teach in Sunday school for 20 years in Birmingham. He taught these very successful Sunday school classes with 100 men who would come every Sunday and hear his Bible classes. The Constitution should be easy to interpret based on its original meaning and its language. And the Constitution should be just like that. And he called this theory originalism. And he came to believe that an original interpretation of the Constitution would stop the justices from inventing new rights that weren't in the Constitution. So remarkably, originalism was also a liberal theory. So judicial restraint was a liberal theory, and originalism was a liberal theory. And Black came to believe, for example, that corporations, this is very relevant today, should not have constitutional rights. Why? Because when the 14th Amendment gave rights to individuals, it spoke of the rights of persons. All persons are entitled to the equal protection of the laws and to due process of law. And Black said, when I last looked it up, a corporation was not a person. Of course, lawyers are very good at getting around these things. And lawyers said, well, a corporation is a person, it's an artificial person. And that became the law in the 1880s, and it remained the law, and it remains the law today. It remains the law today. And Black actually was a dissenter when he said this about the constitutional rights of corporations. But I'm just using it as an example of how you could see that originalism was, for him, a liberal theory. At the end of his life, Black gradually came to be a conservative, only insofar as he believed that all of the rights in the Constitution had already been found by the Supreme Court. This is the late 1960s, early 1970s, many years later. And then he stopped. He said, okay, enough rights. Right? As the court invented more and more and more rights, the liberal court invented more and more and more rights, he thought to himself, it's gone too far. So he lived long enough to see originalism beginning to become a conservative theory instead of a liberal theory. Okay, I've got two more guys to go, and I'll tell you about them very quickly. One, William O. Douglas, is probably the most colorful person ever to sit on the Supreme Court. Douglas had been chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, a job he lobbied for intensively. He had been a law professor without any real national experience, but he became a protege of Joe Kennedy Sr. They would do the things that Kennedys like to do together. And he lobbied very hard for this position. Kennedy was the first chairman of the SEC on the theory that it takes a thief to catch a thief. And he ceded the position to a guy called James Landis and then subsequently to William O. Douglas. Douglas decided that the way to make a national reputation was to go city to city to city and get together the biggest investors in town and tell them that the capital markets were fundamentally broken. And unless they reformed themselves, he, through the SEC, was going to take them over. And he most famously did this with the New York Stock Exchange. He threatened directly the stock exchange that he would take over, a federal takeover of the stock exchange. If it didn't regulate itself, he would regulate it. This did not make him a popular man on Wall Street. He might not have gotten away with it, except that in the weeks that he was negotiating back and forth with the New York Stock Exchange, the former president of the exchange, a man called Richard Whitney, who was at the time tremendously famous. He had been on the front page of Time magazine as the White Knight of Wall Street. That's what they called him. The famous story about Whitney was that on the day that the stock market crashed in 1929, he walked onto the exchange and began to buy shares way below their market value. According to legend, I think it, unfortunately, when you do research for a book, you find out nice stories are sometimes legends. I think this one is a legend, but it is a great story. So Whitney, who had been the president of the exchange, suddenly turned out to be something like $20 million in debt, and he had embezzled, first he embezzled his wife, then he embezzled his brother, then he embezzled the New York Yacht Club, that's my personal favorite, and then last but not least, he embezzled the New York Stock Exchange. So this was all exposed, and then the exchange folded, and Douglas got his wish. This got Douglas to Roosevelt's attention. Roosevelt had actually gone to school with Richard Whitney. They had gone to Groton and Harvard together. And when Douglas went in to tell Roosevelt about this, Roosevelt looked at him and said, "Dick Whitney? Not Dick Whitney." And Douglas said to him, "Yes, Dick Whitney." And he said Roosevelt almost had tears in his eyes. He just couldn't believe it. So Douglas made his reputation attacking Wall Street. And through this fame, he got himself noticed. The president played a game of poker with him and said, "This is the best guy in the New Deal." And a week later, he put him on the Supreme Court. Roosevelt was not done with Douglas, who was 39 years old at the time. He also wanted him to be vice president. He floated him for the vice presidency in 1940. And in 1944, he specifically told the party elders that he preferred Douglas to be his vice president. Everyone knew that to be a vice president in 44 was to be president, because people knew that Roosevelt was not healthy. But the party bosses demanded Truman, because they knew they could control Truman. Douglas was a wild man. And in fact, there's a biography of Douglas called Wild Bill, which is not too much of an overstatement. Douglas remained very politically attuned throughout his time on the Supreme Court, trying to run for president, essentially. He also turned down the vice presidency in 1948 because he said, "I don't want to be second fiddle to a second fiddle." That was his reaction to Truman. Incidentally, just one last anecdote. The reason we know that he said that is that he said it to a very powerful political operative who was the first modern lobbyist, a man called Tommy Corcoran, or Tommy the Cork. And he said it to Tommy Corcoran on the phone. So how do we know that he said this to Tommy Corcoran on the phone? The answer is that Truman hated Tommy the Cork. And so he asked J. Edgar Hoover to tape Tommy the Cork's phone conversations. And every week, twice a week, a special messenger would go from the FBI up to the White House with the transcripts of all of Tommy Corcoran's phone conversations, which Truman would read. So Truman knew about this second fiddle to a second fiddle comment, and he was so desperate in 48, he thought he was going to lose like everybody else thought he was going to lose, that he actually had to go and ask Douglas himself to be his vice president, knowing that Douglas hated him and looked down on him, and he did it anyway, which is a sign either that he was a very big man or a very desperate man, or possibly both. Okay, Douglas struggled to come up with a coherent constitutional philosophy until his life imploded. Around 1951, his life went completely downhill. First, he used to go riding in the mountains in Washington. He fell off a horse. He fell several hundred feet. He broke 40 bones. The joke at the Supreme Court, by now, he and Frankfurter hated each other. Someone said, "Douglas fell off a cliff." And someone else said, "Where was Frankfurter?" Then Douglas got his first divorce. He was the first justice of the Supreme Court to be divorced. Then he was the second justice. Then he was the third justice to be divorced. Each of his wives was progressively younger. The last one he married when he was 69 and she was 22. In this period of personal meltdown, I think it's fair to describe that as personal meltdown, though I'm a young man, so I don't know for sure, he invented a constitutional philosophy, which was to maximize individual liberty. He came to believe that the point of the Constitution was to maximize individual liberty. And today, if you think of the great accomplishments of the court in the 60s, 70s, and even today, with respect especially to sexual and reproductive freedoms, Douglas is at the heart of those. He doesn't usually get the credit for them because, as you can imagine, he's not a very good poster child for the idea that the Constitution maximizes individual sexual liberty. But that is really one of his great, extraordinary legacies. He was also a very important figure in the environmental movement, one of the crucial figures in environmentalism. Last but not least, Robert Jackson, a man who's most famous today for his job as chief prosecutor at Nuremberg, where he took on the Nazi war criminals. Jackson was an amazing guy. He was a small-town lawyer from upstate New York who had been successful in the town of Jamestown, way upstate, and went to work in Washington as general counsel of the IRS. Now, I don't want to offend the general counsel of the IRS if he's in the room, but that is a boring job. And yet, he made it an exciting job because the Roosevelt administration, foolishly, before Jackson got there, had put Andrew Mellon, the third richest American and Secretary of the Treasury for 11 years, on trial for tax fraud. Right? There's no contemporary analog, really, to Andrew Mellon in terms of importance. He was like a combination of Bill Gates, Bob Rubin, I don't know, maybe Alan Greenspan even. I mean, he had that kind of importance nationally. And to go after him for tax fraud was really an extraordinary thing. It was also a very stupid thing because he had good lawyers. Now, he did do things that today we would think of as outrageous. For example, on the last day of the year, if he had any profits, he would make over his entire wealth, hundreds of millions, pushing $1 billion, in 1925 dollars, to his brother for $1 and report a loss. But his lawyers told him this was perfectly okay. And the Roosevelt administration was essentially trying to embarrass him and stick him with an old method of using an old method of tax, essentially what we would call tax cheating. The things started to go very badly. They tried to get an indictment of Mellon in Pittsburgh, where he was the most powerful person. You know, you all know the saying that a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich, but Andrew Mellon was not a ham sandwich, and they couldn't even get an indictment. They threw it in Jackson's lap because he was too unimportant to say no, and he had a multi-week trial face-to-face with Mellon, which put him on the front page of all the newspapers. And a quirky thing, the most interesting aspect of this, is that another thing Mellon had done is that he had the world's best art collection. I don't mean among the best. I mean far and away the best collection of old masters ever assembled by any person, any one person. And what he would do when he needed a tax break is he would donate the works of art to a foundation that he created, the Andrew Mellon Foundation, and they would stay on the wall, and he would take a deduction. So this was embarrassing for him, and what he did on the first day of the trial is his lawyer, Frank Hogan, of the founding partner of the Hogan & Hartson firm, told him, you better announce you're donating them to the nation. And he said, okay, I'm donating them to the nation, and by the way, I'm going to build the National Gallery on the Mall. And so the National Gallery was created because of this tax prosecution. He donated the entire collection with which the National Gallery began, and he also threw in the building, which was way cheaper than the art. So Jackson got noticed because of this, and he came into Roosevelt's inner circle. He got invited to the poker games, which was all important. Then he became Solicitor General. Then he became Attorney General and Roosevelt's most important advisor during World War II, advising him on such things as the Lend-Lease program and the destroyers for bases deals, which were moments when the United States, which was neutral in the war, wanted to help Great Britain despite a U.S. law that said we were neutral. So that was a tough legal problem, and Jackson had to grapple with it. Jackson developed ambition in this period, and he became extraordinarily ambitious, and Roosevelt promised him that he could be Chief Justice. Then, sadly, at the last moment, sadly for Jackson, when Roosevelt had a chance to name the Chief Justice, the war had begun, and various people, including Frankfurter, recommended a Republican sitting justice, Harlan Fiske Stone, for the job. And Roosevelt told Jackson, don't worry, Stone is old, and when he dies, I'll make you the Chief Justice. Jackson believed this, and he continued to really badly want to become Chief Justice, but he did agree to go on the court, grudgingly, to go on the Supreme Court not as Chief Justice. He then was miserable through the war, because he had been at the center of affairs, and now he was irrelevant. The Supreme Court's not so important at various wartime points. However, he became a very interesting figure on the Supreme Court because in his judgments, he said something that no one had ever said before, and this is his distinct constitutional philosophy. And then after a word about Nuremberg, I'll shut up. Jackson said, I don't care what the law says. The system has to work. And the most famous case in which he did that was actually the Steele seizure case that I mentioned to you earlier, where he was faced with the problem that he had authorized, as Attorney General, seizures every bit as significant and every bit as unlawful by FDR. So that was his first problem. Second problem was there was nothing in the Constitution that in any very clear way explained whether the president did or did not have power to seize the steel mills during a war, and the Korean War was going on. So he wrote an opinion, which is today one of the most influential Supreme Court opinions ever written, which said, look, the law is irrelevant here. I'm just going to tell you how it should work. If Congress has spoken, the president's power is at its lowest point. If Congress is silent, it's at the twilight zone, his phrase. And last but not least, if Congress has been silent, the president's power is maximal. Very simple model, not in the Constitution, but reflected this pragmatic judicial philosophy that Jackson possessed. He began also as a liberal, of course, a New Dealer, and became increasingly conservative because of his experiences in Nuremberg. In Nuremberg, he went head-to-head with Goering. It went very badly for him. Goering got the upper hand. I'd be happy to talk more about that in Q&A if people are interested. It was very dramatic. But he did, of course, get convictions, which was pretty much guaranteed at the Nuremberg trials. And at the very end of the trials, when Truman had become president because Roosevelt had died, the Supreme Court's Chief Justice, Harlan Fiske Stone, died, and he said to Truman, okay, where's my Chief Justiceship? And at that point, Black and Douglas, who at this point hated Jackson so profoundly that they couldn't tolerate the idea of his becoming chief, went to Truman and said they would resign from the Supreme Court if he were named Chief Justice. He heard about this in Nuremberg, and he went ballistic. And he wrote a letter, which was published on the front page of every national newspaper, where he accused Black of influencing the court illegally and unlawfully in a case in which his former law partner, Black's former law partner, was arguing things, utterly humiliating Black and utterly humiliating himself. Complete meltdown. Nothing like that has happened in the history of the Supreme Court before, and thank goodness since. Then came back to the court, and once he was on the court, he came to believe that what he had seen in Nuremberg was how Weimar Germany had been too weak against National Socialism, and therefore the United States must be strong on communism. And when the Cold War began and the Supreme Court had to consider convictions of communists, basically for doing nothing more than teaching the Communist Manifesto, Jackson turned into a conservative who upheld those convictions consistently. Frankfurter was also conservative. Douglas and Black were the liberals. So there you pretty much have it. The four modern schools of constitutional law were generated by liberals, and then two became conservative while two remained liberal. Or to be more precise, the judicial restraint is completely flippable. It could be liberal or conservative. It's been conservative. Now it's about to become liberal again. Originalism became conservative. Pragmatism is somewhere in the middle. And the idea that the Constitution is about individual liberty, that's still liberal. And it all happened in this period. And the point that I want to press is, really there are two. One, these were very flawed men, and they were great men. And we need flawed people sometimes, because out of their flaws, they can produce great ideas. The second point is that there are some jobs in the world where getting along and being collegial is absolutely necessary. It's not clear the Supreme Court is one. And I hope many of you heard the really charming moment when Justice O'Connor and Justice Ginsburg were speaking the other day, and they were speaking about the incredible collegiality of the Supreme Court today, and that's absolutely accurate. It is a deeply collegial body. Whether it's a great body is a separate question. The Roosevelt Court was a great body in which the members could not stand each other's sight. And I think there's something interesting to contemplate there. Thanks, and I'm eager to hear your questions. Yes, please. I think there might be microphones to come around, so if you wouldn't mind terribly. There's a gentleman standing up here. Thank you so much.
In behalf of my very good friend, Mimi Clark Runland, daughter of Chief Justice Tom Clark, I'd like to mention that her book, Tom Clark, A Life of Service, has just been published.
Oh, that's great. Can I tell you a Tom Clark story?
And Texas University has just published it. Yeah, surely.
That's great. So Clark was one of Truman's appointees. Clark was an obscure figure in the middle of the Justice Department, whom Truman elevated to Attorney General and then to the Supreme Court. He was one of the people who voted against Truman in the Steele seizure case, which Truman was, to say he was unhappy about it is really a substantial understatement. In an oral history that he gave, this is published, you can look it up, Truman was asked about Tom Clark, and he said, Tom Clark is the worst thing I ever did as a president. Then he said, and I'm quoting exactly here, it's not so much that the man was bad, it's just that he was a dumb son of a bitch. I'm sure that wasn't true, and I'm eager to read the book.
I can intercede in Tom Clark's behalf because, according to his daughter's research, now just the first serious study of Tom Clark, he may have helped the transition from the adversarial court to the more collegial court, because during the Warren Court, apparently he was quite a mediator, and of course he was appointed by a Republican.
Very interesting.
And yet moved to a liberal point of view.
He was appointed by a Democrat.
Key thing that I found from the book is that one time Truman, Tom Clark was the person responsible for the Japanese internment. And later on, he was rising through the Justice Department. One day he was in Buffalo traveling with President Truman on investigations. Truman was senator. There was a snowstorm, of course. The planes didn't run regularly. There was only one flight left with very few seats. Tom Clark had the ticket. He gave it to the senator, and he was able to get back to his vote. Senator Truman never forgot that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sounds very interesting. I should mention the Japanese internment just momentarily. That's a very important episode in the history of the period I'm talking about, and I didn't mention it now. I was speaking generally positively about my subjects. They disastrously failed at the time of the Japanese internment. They were all FDR appointees. They all were liberals. They all voted to uphold the internment, with Justice Jackson being the closest to it. He wrote a partial dissent where he wasn't concerned about the Japanese Americans. He was concerned about the Constitution. And he said, well, if you uphold a conviction of a Japanese American here, then the courts have said that this internment is okay. So what we should do is not uphold the conviction, but we should just let the military intern the Japanese Americans. So it's not a creditable moment in the history of the Supreme Court and not in the lives of these men. Their loyalty to President Roosevelt and the wartime conditions outstripped their sense of proper constitutional values, I think. Yes, sir, please, right in the front.
Excuse me. For a great talk. Could you take us through how it's gone from nomination, confirmation in 2 days? Was it just Bork, or was there more than that that's gotten to where we are now in terms of confirmation?
That's a great question. So after Brandeis, the next justice who had a lengthy confirmation hearing was actually Felix Frankfurter, another Jewish nominee, not the next, but another. He was accused of being a communist. He had, in fact, defended Sacco and Vanzetti, the Italian anarchists who were convicted of South Braintree armed robbery. Sacco and Vanzetti, I ended up learning a lot about them and working on this project. They're fascinating people. They actually belonged to a very extensive terrorist cell, which did carry out major bombings, including the first car bombing was actually a wagon bombing on Wall Street that killed 45 people right on Wall Street. So they were actually, Sacco and Vanzetti may or may not have been guilty of the robbery for which they were convicted, but they were certainly part of a very extensive terror network. And he had defended them, claiming that they were innocent. And he had been a founding member of the National Advisory Committee of the ACLU and the NAACP. And so he was accused of being a communist. And he gave a very moving speech in the Senate in response. And he, by the way, I should add, was the first reason I'm mentioning this is Frankfurter was the first justice to appear himself at his confirmation hearings. Brandeis did not appear at his confirmation hearings. Frankfurter was the first person actually to appear. So that was the first time that a justice had to be put directly to questions. And when he was asked, are you or have you ever been a communist? He said, Senator, I subscribe to the principles of Americanism more profoundly than you ever will, and I rest on that answer. And there was applause in the gallery, and he got confirmed. But that was the precedent for a confrontational confirmation hearing. And I think you're right to say that the Bork hearing was the first one where ideology was expressly made the central topic of discussion in the confirmation hearings. And it's a very interesting historical question whether that was worthwhile or not, especially from the standpoint of the people who raised it and made the argument that Judge Bork was, quote unquote, out of the mainstream. On the one hand, they kept Bork off the court, and instead they got Tony Kennedy, who, appointed by Ronald Reagan, has turned out to be a very important liberal justice. I mean, Justice Kennedy, whom I like very much, does not consider himself a liberal. He's more of a libertarian in some way, in that he stands up for the individual liberties of gay people. He stood up for the detainees in Guantanamo, and he stands up very strongly for the rights of corporations and the rights of states. So he likes rights in a remarkably consistent way, in a way that's not true of any of the other 8 justices. So he's an interesting and complicated person. On the other hand, the result has been that our nominations are now, the process of confirmation is now, as you've just seen, I mean, Elena is a close friend of mine, and she's a wonderful person, and I'm really glad that she did well, and I'm sure she'll be confirmed. But, you know, she couldn't say anything. And one of the reasons that she was nominated, apart from her excellent qualifications, is that she's never said much of anything. Right? And I don't mean that in a bad way. You know, she's been extremely cautious and a terrific public servant, and that made her confirmable. It's up to everyone to judge whether we're better off that way. Certainly, looking at the period that I've been talking about today and that I've been writing about and studying, opinions were extremely strong, and none of the people I'm writing about would have had a prayer of being confirmed today. You know, a U.S. senator who had taken positions on everything and had been a Klan member, right? The most prominent liberal professor in the country who became a judicial conservative, Felix Frankfurter. You know, I didn't mention this, but when everybody else on the liberal court realized they had a majority, they gave up judicial restraint. And they became activists. And Frankfurter said, what are you doing? We're liberals. We believe in judicial restraint. And he stuck with it the rest of his life. That made him a conservative. Right? He could never have gotten onto the court. He's the only man in the history of the Supreme Court to be so either naive or honest. Take your pick. You know, Jackson had been attorney general and tremendously controversial, could almost certainly not have been confirmed. And Douglas, forget about it. You know, I mean, Douglas was sort of like Elizabeth Warren or somebody, you know, standing out there and just yelling at Wall Street. Yes, please, in the corner.
Trials?
Mm.
Thank you.
Sure. The question was about the Nuremberg trials. I'd be happy to say a word about that. So Jackson faced two major challenges in Nuremberg. One was legal and the other was political. The legal challenge was, how do you run a trial of people whom the whole world knows are guilty of atrocities, who haven't obviously, in any obvious way, committed a crime that violated any existing law? Right? There was no convention against genocide at the time. There was no obvious crime that the Nazis had committed. That was the legal challenge. The political challenge was, how do you show the world that the Nazis were in the wrong? The way Jackson dealt with the legal challenge was through an extraordinary address, which is the opening statement, which you can look up and even watch on video on YouTube, where he made the following extraordinary argument. He said, well, it's true that there was no really clear law that the Nazis violated, but they were guilty of an international crime against humanity of aggressive war. Now, there was no treaty making it a crime to wage aggressive war. And he admitted that. He said, well, no treaty explicitly says this. What's more, he says, at the time of World War I, this wasn't against the law. But he says, and this is a quote, the 1920s outlawed aggressive war. Now, you don't have to be a lawyer to know that the 1920s is not a legal body. It's a decade, right? Essentially, Jackson's argument was that a customary practice of states had emerged according to which it was a crime to wage aggressive war. The only problem, of course, is that the Germans, an important country, had not apparently noticed that this had happened. And he responded to that argument explicitly by saying, well, so much the worse for them. His punchline, though, was deeply pragmatic, and this is the interesting part. Jackson's punchline was to say, if law is to be valuable at all, it has to be able to take account of a situation where we all know an evil has occurred. Otherwise, law cannot sustain civilization. That was his legal argument. And what you think of that will tell you something about your own inner legal philosophy. If you like that argument, then you're a pragmatist like Jackson. Then you believe that law has to fit the circumstances, has to do the job, and if it can't solve these problems, it's kind of useless to us. If, on the other hand, you think that justice is what matters, and that law is just a way of saying that we won't put people in prison or otherwise punish them unless they violated some clear rule, right? Then you'll think that what Jackson said was preposterous and violated the basic ideal of the rule of law, which is that you can't be punished unless there's a law you've broken. Right? That's a deep philosophical question, and I think all sides have a view on it, but Jackson's view was very clearly the pragmatist view, and it was very similar to what he said on the bench. The political side of the Nuremberg trial involved convincing the world that the Nazis were really bad, and here he had to go through Goering. And he chose to cross-examine Goering, who was the highest-ranking Nazi still left alive. And as I said earlier, it was a complete disaster. All of those in the room at the time, in the international and the national press, all said that Goering got the upper hand and did much better than Jackson did, and that Jackson looked like a country lawyer outmatched by a European sophisticate. And he got in deeper and deeper, and as Jackson got more and more upset, and he had been a very skilled trial lawyer his whole life, so it was surprising to see it going this badly, he turned to the court, the tribunal, and said, I want you to restrict the defendant's answers to yes or no. The court said, no, we won't do that. And he went back again and said, I want you to, they said no. Finally, they recessed for the afternoon, and he went into their private chambers and said, unless you restrict his answers, I'm going to resign in the middle of the trial. They said, sorry, no. So it actually went extraordinarily badly. What Goering was essentially trying to show the world was that this was victor's justice. What Jackson was trying to show was that the Nazis were horrible and evil. Ultimately, in historical memory, we think of Nuremberg mostly as a success, partly because Jackson showed video footage from Auschwitz and other death camps that was so extraordinarily powerful that it stuck in the public mind. But as an actual trial, it's interesting to think that Nuremberg was not so successful, and it gives you a different perspective on various war crimes tribunals today, which also often are not very successful in the execution. What matters is generally the final conclusion of a conviction. It's a deep problem with respect to war crimes trials. It remains a deep problem. Yes, please.
Today you have Scalia's originalism.
Sorry, Bill. Here, I'll give it to him. Sure. I don't want to break the union rules, but here, Bill. Here you go.
Today you have Nino Scalia saying the Constitution is a document that should be literally interpreted the way it was written in the late 19th century. And you have Steve Breyer talking about a living Constitution. Now, I can see how these two points of view relate to the four traditions you've outlined, but they're not identical. Could you tell me a little bit about how this debate has evolved recently?
Sure. It's interesting. I've spoken to Justice Scalia about what sort of a debt he does or does not owe to Justice Black. Justice Scalia, as you know, with Justice Thomas, is the leading exponent of the idea of the original meaning of the Constitution. And like Justice Black, he cares both about the history of the Constitution and about the words of the Constitution. There's originalism, and there's a little other idea there, sometimes called textualism, that the text of the Constitution is what matters. Sometimes they're at odds. But Justice Scalia says he believes in both of them, the same way Black did. So I asked Justice Scalia about this about a year ago when I was working on the book, and he said to me, yeah, I've never really thought that much about Black. So in Justice Scalia's mind, he came up with this view on his own. Now, this might be a little bit like the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, who was asked about the influences of other philosophers on him. He said, oh, I've never read any philosophy. Right? You should take such things with a bit of a grain of salt. But it is true that at the end of his career, when Justice Black believed that the rights found by the Warren Court had gone as far as they could go and were going beyond the words of the Constitution, the right to privacy in particular, which, as you know, the word privacy doesn't appear in the Constitution, he himself started to say no, and originalism began to be a conservative worldview. I think what happened is that as the Supreme Court went further and further in a liberal direction of discovering constitutional rights that came really from the ether, or that came from, you know, the ideal of autonomy, not from the Constitution itself, the Douglas view, the idea that the Supreme Court shouldn't be doing this because it wasn't in the words of the Constitution became increasingly logical and appealing to conservatives. It's very much similar to the way the judicial restraint argument was a liberal argument when conservatives ran the court and liberals ran the Congress. Then it became a conservative argument when you had liberal Congresses and attacks on, sorry, a conservative argument when you had a liberal Supreme Court. And now it's in the process, you saw this in the Kagan hearings, of becoming a liberal argument again, because now you have a conservative court finding constitutional rights for corporations. So it's what we like to call flippable in law school, you know? It's a flippable idea. And originalism, I think, is a bit the same in this regard. With respect to the living Constitution, you know, Justice Breyer, you know, he's a very, very interesting thinker, but he's very hard to pin down, which is why I would put him in the category of a pragmatist. I think he's much more of a Jacksonian pragmatist, as indeed I think is Justice O'Connor. A good example of this would be the opinion of Justice O'Connor's, which Justice Breyer joined, saying that affirmative action... So you might ask an interesting question, is it constitutional or isn't it? Justice O'Connor said, it is for 25 years. Right? So that's pragmatic. The 25 years are not in the Supreme Court. Are not in the Constitution. So if you're a pragmatist, you will love that opinion because you'll say, that's nuanced, it's subtle, it says let's sideline this issue for now and re-examine it and see if we've made progress in race relations in 25 years. And she wrote that before President Obama was elected. If you think that the Constitution should be interpreted according to its original meaning, you will not feel positively towards that. Or if you think that it should be about evolving liberties, you probably won't feel positive towards it. I think Justice Breyer falls into that category to some degree as well, but he is willing to talk about a living constitution because he likes the idea of pragmatic solutions. Yes, please. Just there. Oh, sorry, we need the microphone back.
Given your talk on the dynamics of interpreting the Constitution, heading toward a different element to your own experience, when you were coming up with the principles in drafting a constitution for Iraq, what were the principles that you felt were absolutely critical to have in the document that would allow it both to have the flexibility that you talk about in our own constitution, but also the fundamentalisms or the fundamental principles that would guide justice?
That's a great question. The first thing I would say is, you know, drafting of a constitution only means anything in the long run if the people in the country will adopt the values of that constitution, right? Otherwise, you have a beautiful constitution that everyone ignores. The world is littered with such constitutions. So the most important thing was to ground the fundamental values in something that would mean something to Iraqis, so they would make it their own document. And in the case of Iraq, Islam, believe it or not, was the most powerful source of collective values. Democracy is a nice idea, and many Iraqis say they like democracy, but they really didn't know anything about democracy. As a result, the Constitution, and I think its most important provisions, says that it is based both on democratic values and on Islamic values, and here's the kicker, it declares that they are compatible. Right? So for the better part of a decade, the 90s and the first part of the decade we just had, whatever it's supposed to be called, I thought we would think of a name for it during the decade, but we didn't. There was a big debate about, are Islam and democracy compatible? Now that debate has receded, in part because of political acts like writing in the Constitution, yes, they are. And then leaving it to future Iraqi legislators and courts to work out what that relationship is. And an interesting analogy there, though believe me, one I never mentioned in Iraq, is that in Israel, the constitutional documents, they don't have a single constitution, but they have these documents, say that the state is Jewish and democratic. And, of course, imply that, those two things are compatible. And it's up to the courts and the legislature to try to work out what that means. And it's not an easy question. The same will be true in Iraq. But I think the key to the Iraqi constitution is that it acknowledges the role of religion while simultaneously treating religion as a source of basic rights. Our constitution doesn't do that, but of course our Declaration of Independence does. And there are still Americans, many of them, who believe that we have our rights not because they come from the constitution, but because we got them from a creator who endowed us with them and that they are inalienable. It's not such a radical idea. Yes, please, Sam.
Really enjoyed your talk, Noah. You referenced the hands-on management style of Franklin Roosevelt and, to a lesser extent, Truman. Lyndon Johnson's probably the most hands-on involved politician of our generation, certainly when he was in the Senate, the House, and the President. Can you elaborate on his involvement with the Supreme Court and perhaps reference Thurgood Marshall's appointment?
Yeah, I mean, all these presidents, as you say, Sam, were very actively, personally involved. When Roosevelt was president, when there was this incident where a group of saboteurs landed in the United States, German saboteurs came off of submarines. This isn't that widely known. A group of them, four landed in Florida and four landed in, if you can believe it, Amagansett, in the Hamptons. One of them then turned himself in. They were caught. They were put on trial. The president had Henry Stimson, who was the Secretary of Defense, ask his old mentee, Felix Frankfurter, what he should do about it. Frankfurter was going to sit on the court that was going to rule on the constitutionality of whatever they did, and he gave good practical advice. That was the kind of thing that happened constantly. Truman, as you say. Johnson continued that tradition, most famously by forcing Arthur Goldberg off the Supreme Court by offering him the job of ambassador to the United Nations. But it was more than just an offer. It was sort of an offer he couldn't refuse. And trying to replace him with, and replacing him with Abe Fortas, whom he then tried to elevate to Chief Justice, and when Fortas ran into trouble in that nomination for Chief Justice, had to resign. The nomination of Thurgood Marshall to the Supreme Court, similarly political. The Kennedys had their ambivalences about Thurgood Marshall being appointed, and Bobby Kennedy, in particular, was Attorney General, had his ambivalences about it, and said so explicitly to Thurgood Marshall, which is how we know about it, in terms that I actually won't repeat here. But he told him, you and your community, I'm very much paraphrasing here, have not earned a seat on this, even the, on the Supreme Court. He told Marshall that to his face. Bobby Kennedy did. But it was forced, but he didn't put it that politely. But Johnson wanted it, and he made it happen. He made him his Solicitor General. He made Thurgood Marshall his Solicitor General. Then he put him on the Second Circuit very briefly, and then he put him on the Supreme Court. And it was very clearly a political judgment for him. We've exhausted all questions. That would be great. In the very far back, the woman raising her hand.
Growing up in Charleston, South Carolina, where there were billboards that said, "Save our Republic, impeach Earl Warren," please, and Earl Warren being described as Eisenhower described as his biggest damn mistake. Please tell me how he changed personally to become what he was.
Thank you so much for that question. Brown against the Board of Education, which was the decision that created those billboards, among many other changes, is, most people think, the high point of the history of the Supreme Court. And most people think of it as the first act of the Warren Court, but in fact it was also the last act of the Roosevelt Court, because it was the last decision that was reached by a Supreme Court in which a majority of justices had been named by Franklin Roosevelt. And it was very dramatic, because when it was first argued in front of the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice was not Earl Warren, but Fred Vinson, the Kentuckian buddy of Truman's, who, alongside Tom Clark, who was from Texas, and Stanley Reed, who was from Kentucky, said in conference that they were not prepared to strike down segregation. And Justice Frankfurter did not think it was appropriate to have a split vote on such a controversial question, and he convinced the other justices they should hold the case over, that is, not decide at all, and wait till the next year and hear argument again. Over the summer, Fred Vinson died of a heart attack. And when Frankfurter came back to Washington on the train for the funeral, he was met by his law clerk, Phil Ellman, at the train, his former law clerk, Phil Ellman, who worked for the Solicitor General's office at the time and was working on the case. He met him at Union Station in D.C., and Frankfurter grabbed him by the arm and said to him, "Phil, this is the first evidence I have ever had that there is a God." With Vinson's death, the door opened for Eisenhower to name a Chief Justice, because Truman was coming to the end of his term, Eisenhower was elected, and then Eisenhower had the opportunity to name it, had already become president, and he nominated Earl Warren. Rumor had it that he had promised Earl Warren was a prominent California politician, had been attorney general and governor, had also played a big role in the Japanese-American internment. He was strongly in favor of that internment, interestingly. And rumor had it that Eisenhower had promised him the a justiceship in exchange for his support at the Republican convention in 1952, when Warren threw the California delegation to Eisenhower, which enabled Eisenhower to win on the first ballot. So it was a political payoff. He comes on the court. There are still three justices who are thinking about voting the other way, and Warren begins to twist their arms. And he twists their arms one at a time, and first Clark folds, then Robert Jackson, who interestingly wanted to write a separate opinion in the case, saying that the only reason, Constitution doesn't matter, the only reason we're striking down segregation now is that blacks have advanced a lot from where they were in the old days, so it was right to deny them rights then, but it's right to give them rights now. The other justice didn't think that was such a good idea. He had a heart attack, went into the hospital, and Warren went to see him in the hospital and was like, "You can't publish this opinion," and he folded because he was in this hospital bed. That left just Stanley Reed, and Warren went to Stanley Reed, and he said to him, "Stan, you're all alone now." And Reed folded. And so he got the unanimity that he wanted. Jackson then rose from his hospital bed, went to the Supreme Court against doctor's orders. They announced the Brown versus the Board of Education decision, 9-0, one of the great moments in the history of the Supreme Court, certainly the greatest moment in the history of the Roosevelt Court and the opening moment in the history of the Warren Court. And that fall, before the Supreme Court could sit again, Jackson died himself, had a heart attack in the apartment of his secretary, who had accompanied him to Nuremberg and with whom I think he had really shared a deeply loving relationship. And that was the end of the Roosevelt Court. Thank you all very, very much.